I don't exclude the possibility that the problem fell from the sky, meaning there was an explosion. It's impossible to say whether it was a military rocket, but why did the young people leave their tent in such a hurry?
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia and a bunker below ground, I am Micah Hanks. Welcome one and all to the program. Glad to be here with you, as always, as we go heading off into the heart of the mysterious, like we do every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. And Maya, don't we have a lot in store for you. Autumn is in the air here in Appalachia. I guess I'm just in the mood. And we are going to be covering what was going on out there in the Nevada desert this weekend. We also have some very interesting news about human ancestry and how genetics is painting a picture, quite literally, of what the ancient past and, more importantly, what many human ancestors actually looked like. And then on the subject of Google, have they achieved quantum supremacy? They at very least claim that they have. Some new information has come to light. In fact, it was leaked accidentally, and this is setting the stage for the future of computation. Big news indeed. But then for the remainder of the program, we are going to take a deep dive in search of answers to one of the true great modern mysteries, and that is the Dyatlov Pass incident. There's been much written and said about this, and to try and look at the latest information forthcoming, keeping in mind that there was a new report earlier this year that Russian authorities were reopening the case. They're only looking at three possibilities that are weather-related in terms of what might have happened that caused the deaths of those hikers. But are there other aspects that should be considered? We're going to look at a lot of the details and some pretty controversial opinions of experts who have been looking at this case. So we've got a lot to get into. So, how you guys doing out there? Hope everybody is doing great. I hope you guys are fabulous. I know you are. I was feeling pretty fabulous over the weekend, even though I spent my days in the mountains enjoying the cool autumn air and not out there in the arid desert. I had a good excuse, right? Ma, I had a bad case of the Naruto runs, okay? I couldn't get out there and enjoy the festivities because this was the weekend, okay? This is when it was all supposed to go down, the infamous raid of Area 51. Come on, we gotta have a little fun with this, right? Although things could have gotten really out of hand. Fortunately, they didn't. And what actually began as a joke online that morphed into this crazy potential onslaught, and then finally kind of fizzled out as a festival, well, it's all come and gone. And the LA Times reports that the festivals are over, the Earthlings from around the globe headed home Sunday after a weekend camping and partying in the dusty Nevada desert and trekking to remote gates of Area 51, a formerly top-secret U.S. military base long the focus of UFO and space alien lore. They left in peace, officials and the host of a free alien stock festival said Sunday. Visitors hailed from France, Russia, Germany, Peru, Sweden, Australia, and many U.S. states, many toting cameras in answer to an internet post in June suggesting that if enough people rushed a military base, Naruto running to see them aliens at 3 a.m. on September 20th, authorities couldn't stop everyone. Indeed, this could have been a lot worse than it ended up being. And after all, there were more than 2 million Facebook users who had clicked their interest in this, saying that they were going to show up. But as is usually the case, there's an awful lot of talk and very little game. The millions who said they'd be there turned out to be only a few thousand, although a few thousand is still pretty significant, right? That would show up out there in Nevada. And actually, where they ended up going was the nearest town to Area 51. That's Rachel. Rachel has a population, according to the LA Times, of about 50. It is home of the famous Little Ailey Inn. Campers and festival goers in Rachel peaked at about 3,000 on Friday, according to Eric Holt, the Lincoln County official who headed planning for a feared influx of 10 times that. They said that they expected there could be 30,000 people. I maintain, again, 3,000 people is actually quite a few. They say a few hundred more camped and attended one night of an abbreviated festival about 40 miles away in Hico, which has a slightly larger population of about 120. They say it seems like a lot of good people chilling and having a good time. This according to Dave Wells, a 56-year-old stonemason and festival seeker from Cincinnati wearing a Dayglow green festival t-shirt and taking in the scene Saturday there in Rachel. But fortunately for all parties involved, the alien-themed event went down without further incident. Nobody was hurt, thank goodness. Nobody tried to see them aliens and actually storm Area 51. Yeah, that one certainly could have turned out for the worse. I'm glad it didn't. In other news, I've been fascinated for a long time with the Denisovans. And this, of course, being an ancient human ancestor similar to Neanderthals, which we only recently discovered at the type site Denisova Cave there in Russia. And the enigmatic fingertip of a young girl, Woman X, was mostly destroyed so that they could extract mitochondrial DNA information, because the genomic information that was extracted tells us a lot more than the actual fingertip did. And after taking that risk of destroying the only remains we had of this ancient human ancestor so as to be able to obtain information about their DNA, we have since that time recovered other fossil evidence of Denisovans. But researchers have now been able to utilize some of that genetic information to reconstruct what Denisovans looked like. And from the initial results that we're seeing, they do indeed resemble Neanderthals. According to Liran Carmel from the Department of Genetics at Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Israel, he said, in many ways, Denisovans resembled Neanderthals, but in some traits they resembled us, and in others they were entirely unique. Indeed, the researchers identified 56 anatomical features that distinguished Denisovans from both modern humans and Neanderthals. The bulk of those 36 were in the skull. The reconstruction suggests a Denisovan skull was wider and that they had a longer dental arch than we do. Now, reporting on the discovery, Newsweek notes that as far as similarities go, the researchers believe the Denisovans had an elongated face and a wide pelvis, again, like Neanderthals, who they separated from sometime between 390 to 440,000 years ago. Their ancestors split from ours 520 to 630,000 years ago, but also recent studies have shown that up to 6% of DNA in present-day Melanesians and Aboriginal Australians can be traced to the Denisovans. East Asians, Native Americans, and Polynesians also share Denisovan DNA, but to a lesser degree. And again, it's really pretty fascinating. In fact, I can't emphasize how fascinating it is that we have so little as a fingertip, some skull fragments, and other fossil remains of Denisovans, and yet with the DNA information that we've extracted, that alone tells us so much about these individuals. We can actually see, quite literally, what they look like. We can compare them to other known ancient human ancestors and to ourselves. And let's not forget that, again, the current DNA studies also indicate that there are at least two other extinct hominin varieties that humans interbred with, which we have not found corollaries for yet in the fossil record. And like we've talked about plenty of times in the past, that's not unusual. There are a lot of reasons why different organisms don't show up in the fossil record. For my own part, while I understand that we learn an awful lot about the past from what we find in fossils, I think it's a little naive to base all of our ideas and expectations for life that has come and gone on Earth explicitly on what we find in the fossil record. After all, there are probably animals in different environments and habitats that are not conducive to fossil formation. There's probably been a lot more on Earth than we'll ever know, but fossils do give us a lot of good ideas about what kinds of things have come and gone. But in the absence of evidence in the fossil record of early hominin types, again, point in case, the genetic information already shows that there are at least two kinds that we haven't found in the fossil record yet. I guess we better keep searching. But again, we learn an awful lot from the DNA alone. That is very exciting. And we're also learning an awful lot here in the era of computing, because Google has now come out and claimed its quantum computer has performed a calculation that could be practically impossible for even the best supercomputer. In other words, as far as computing goes in the world, Google is now saying that they have attained quantum supremacy. That's right. Now, if this is true, and perhaps it should be taken with a grain of salt, but if it's true, it is big news. Quantum computers have the potential, of course, to change the way that we design new materials, how we work out logistics, how we build artificial intelligence, how we break encryption codes, all kinds of different things. And that is why firms like Google and others, Intel and IBM are among other contenders, and along with plenty of other smaller startups you've probably never heard of, but who are no doubt involved in the same game, so to speak. They've all been racing to reach this crucial milestone, which Google is now claiming. So, New Scientist reported over the weekend that this development at Google is shrouded in intrigue. They say, quote, a paper containing details of the work was posted to a NASA server last week before being quickly removed, and hence how we probably learned about it. Several media outlets reported on the rumors, but Google has not commented on them themselves. A copy of the paper that was seen by New Scientist contains details of a quantum processor called Sycamore. That's kind of a pedestrian name for something so potentially earth-shaking, right? But Sycamore, they say, contains 54 superconducting quantum bits, or qubits. It claims that Sycamore has achieved quantum supremacy, and the paper identifies only one author, John Martinez, at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who is known to have partnered with Google to build the hardware for a quantum computer. Now, of course, this brings to mind what we reported last week, right? And if you recall, that involves how Google has drawn some criticism from some of its employees, both present and former, on account of the fact that there is all this secrecy surrounding their involvement with a Pentagon program called Maven. And in an era where we have tech giants like Google, guys who essentially own the World Wide Web, they may not really own it, but they certainly moderate it. And with the help of subsidiary ownerships, partnerships, and things with companies like YouTube and all these others, I mean, again, Google is closing its grip on more and more web content, which in many ways is making things more difficult for content providers. And so, again, Huxley's idea of a brave new world always comes to mind when we start talking about things like this, because I'm looking at these kinds of things, and although there are all these milestones and achievements that are awaiting us, I think that some of this gives us cause for pause as well. Maybe we should be somewhat concerned, at least, about some of these developments that are occurring almost daily in the tech world. But returning to the New Scientist article, they refer to this as a dramatic speed-up relative to all known classical algorithms, which provides an experimental realization of quantum supremacy on a computational task and heralds the advent of a much-anticipated computing paradigm. I'll tell you what else comes to mind here. The singularity. That's right, that event horizon where all of what we expect and what we think we know begins to break down in a brave new world that becomes so bizarre with the help of computers and perhaps artificial intelligence and other kinds of things, reality as we know it suddenly becomes really weird. It's like Werner Vinge wrote about in the 1980s when he first proposed the concept. He said, you'll look out one day and things won't appear as they should be. We won't really be able to distinguish what is real and what is synthetic anymore. And echoing Vinge's idea, I definitely think that computation is going to take us in that direction in the next few years, maybe sooner than we expect. Now, Google appears to have partnered with NASA, they say, according to New Scientist, to help test its quantum computer. In 2018, the two organizations made an agreement to do this, so the news isn't entirely unexpected. The paper, they say, describes how Google's quantum processor tackled a random sampling problem, that is, checking that a set of numbers has a truly random distribution. This is very difficult for a traditional computer when there are a lot of numbers involved. But they say Sycamore does things differently. And although one of its qubits didn't work, they say the remaining 53 were quantum entangled with one another and used to generate a set of binary digits and indeed check that their distribution was truly random. The paper, they say, calculates the task would have taken Summit, which is the world's best supercomputer at present, 10,000 years to complete the same task. Sycamore, they say, did it in 3 minutes and 20 seconds. Brave new world indeed. So, shifting gears for a moment here, you know, one of the things that I really love about this time of the year, apart from all the wacky news that is foretelling a future we may not be ready for yet when it comes to quantum computing and the like. Now, one of the things that I really love about autumn is being able to get out on the road and travel. One of my favorite places to go is Nashville, not only because it's Music City, but because of all the wonderful friends I have over that way, which includes the gentlemen who are joining us right now. Adam Sane and Serfiel of the Conspiranormal Podcast, longtime friends of mine. They had been listeners of my program. They've been podcasting now for years. And I hear, Adam, that you're now getting into the realm of doing events as well.
Yes, sir, we are. We got something coming up pretty soon. And let me say, I am very happy. We are very happy to be on the Micah Hank Show.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been a long time coming.
Well, good to have you guys on here. I'm sure it won't be the last time. I always love to have my friends on and rap with people. And tell you the truth, with podcasting, a lot of the time, I'm like one of those old-time radio guys, not like old time, although I love old time radio, but I mean, I came from actual broadcast, and for me, I've always approached podcasting like that. One of the great things about podcasting, however, is just kind of the roundtable format, being able to sit down with people that you may agree or not agree with and see where the conversation goes. That's really the fun part of it, I think. Well, tell us about this event that you guys are going to be doing. This is going to be in mid-October, I believe, and you have a wonderful selection of speakers, but I'll let you guys tell us about it.
Yeah, so what we're doing, Micah, is we're doing something called that we are calling the Strange Realities Conference, and we're putting this on here in lovely Nashville, Tennessee, on October 19th. So we've got about a little less than 5 weeks now from the time we're recording this till we actually get this thing going on. So we've got several different speakers that we've got about, I believe we got about like seven speakers that we got at this little conference that we're doing over here.
I know that the notorious Tim Banal is going to be there.
Yeah. Tim Banal is going to be speaking about the kind of like rise and fall and the bizarre world of the flat earth theory.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of like a more, as I understand it, a more kind of dispassionate kind of view of just the history of the flat earth theory. Maybe like its past, its present, and possible future or our demise. And we've also got speaking our good friend, Micah, who I don't think I would have ever known had it not been heard it on your show way back in the day, which is Joshua Cutchin.
That's right. Yeah.
And Josh has written several books that we know of, Trojan Feast, Brimstone Deceit, Thieves in the Night. And he's working on a new book right now with another author, which is also going to be there, named Timothy Renner, who is the host of the Strange Familiars podcast. Gotten really popular now.
Absolutely. Timothy's a really interesting guy. He and I actually participated in a simulcast of sorts on another program, and we weren't really on at the exact same time. I'd really hoped to be able to riff with him on the microphone a bit. Really interesting fella, though. And, of course, it goes without saying, Josh Cutchin, a mutual friend of, I think, everybody in the community. But I think before he'd ever written any of his books, he had already been on this show because I was eager to talk with him. He was like you. He was someone who reached out and said, you know, yep, I love all this stuff. And I told him, I said, some of your research is interesting enough that you could write a book. I'm so glad after all these years. Now he's three or four in and got others on the way. Great guy.
Oh, yeah, he absolutely is. And Tim as well, Timothy Renner, he's written several books at this point. And they're going to do a joint presentation at the last presentation of the night is going to be about that book, Our Books Now, Where the Footprints End.
Interesting.
And Timothy Renner is going to be speaking about the Pennsylvania Wild Man flap of the 1920s.
Interesting. Yeah, I like all those archival reports. If you dig through newspaper archives and things, you'll find a lot of accounts of alleged wild men in early newspaper accounts. So that's an interesting subject. Guy Malone's also going to be there, as I understand, right?
Yes, he is. Yeah, a good friend, Guy Malone, who I have known for almost 10 years now. Met him at a conference here in Nashville. He's actually a native Nashvillian, and he is going to be speaking about what really happened at Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. And he actually lives now in Roswell, New Mexico, and he's the founder of the Alien Resistance Group. So really looking forward to that. I saw him give that presentation actually when we were in Roswell for the 70th anniversary.
Now, from his press photo, though, I was of the mind that he was actually one of the aliens.
Yeah, that's him as the alien stranger.
I see. Well, I think we all feel a little like alien strangers from time to time. Now, the event is on October 19th, correct?
Yes, sir.
That's right. Yeah. Now, obviously, you guys are selling tickets in advance, but I mean, is this going to be available at the door for walk-ins and things? How can people find out about the event and where they can learn about it or buy tickets online?
Yeah, well, all you got to do is go to strangerealitiesconference.com. We've got a link there that takes you straight to the Eventbrite page. And it is now $30. It's $30 when you buy on the Eventbrite page. Now, the day of, it's going to be $40 at the door. And if you go to strangerealitiesconference.com, you can get that price for $30.
Excellent.
And that's all the way to October 18th.
Yeah, I believe I'm going to be traveling. I'm hoping maybe I can sneak away and come over and visit you guys. If I don't make it this time, I'm going to be with you guys in spirit. It sounds like a really fun time that you guys will be having at this event. Of course, you've got all of the key players, all of the usual suspects, so I'm sure that it'll be a fun time. But of course, let's not forget that this is something that has grown out of the podcast you've been doing for a number of years. And of course, you've got your new co-host and producer. So it sounds like you guys are doing great, really making some waves.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're going to have a live recording of the podcast, too, mm-hmm. as the final presentation.
Adam, what number are we up to, by the way?
Tonight, we are going to record number 281.
Wow. There you go.
Which is actually a little more than that, considering that we've done a couple. We did like our 100th episode. It was actually two episodes. You were there for that almost 4 years ago now, believe it or not. And the 200th episode, I split into two, and we've had some bonus episodes too. So we're probably closer to 300 now.
Yeah.
Actual episodes.
When you do it long enough, just like I did, you'll start losing count. Eventually it happens. But hey, you know, here's to 200 and so more episodes. And I'm sure that you guys are going to keep going. It's great stuff that you do. Adam, I appreciate both you guys for coming on, and hopefully we'll hear some more about this fantastic event. One more time, just let people know what the event's called.
It's called the Strange Realities Conference, and you can purchase tickets at strangerealitiesconference.com.
Excellent. Strangerealitiesconference.com, October 19th in Nashville, Tennessee. Okay, so I do want to get to a few listener emails, and I always love it when I get a real letter from somebody in the mail. Jaina the Earth Nerd not only sent along a letter, but as you're about to hear, she sent along some little relics from the ancient past, the kind of thing that I absolutely love. And she writes, "Micah, I hope this finds you well. I've been quite busy this summer and have several episodes to catch up on, but right now I'm still catching up on a few domestic things. Jim and I went out to Wyoming a few times this season as I was asked to lead a couple of trips to help excavate dinosaurs and another one to help with the kids and parents trip. Oh my God, what fun. I haven't been able to make donations recently, and I should note, by the way, that this letter was addressed to Middle Theory, which is the other podcast I do, and it is exclusively driven by donations from the listenership. However, the content here obviously is more pertinent to this program, hence I'm reading the letter here. But she says, I do hope that you will accept some fossils and minerals as a token of my appreciation for everything you do. Sorry the dinosaur bones had to stay in Wyoming." Understandable. I wouldn't consider myself so fortunate to just randomly get dinosaur fossils in the mail, but the fossils that she sent were cool nonetheless. As she explains, she says, enclosed are a few balaamnites, that is, squid butts, approximately 130 million-year-old squid butts, and also a few pieces of a mineral called gethite, along with some literature that explains what each size of the balaamnite is called and how gethite is formed. I hope that you enjoy them, and thank you for everything that you do. Peace and light, Jaina the Earth Nerd. And she writes in a handwritten postscript here, the mineral is selenite, a gypsum, with iron oxide. Peace. Thank you so much, Jaina. That is arguably one of the coolest notes I've gotten from a listener in a long time. In fact, it might be even cooler than an actual cash donation. Gifts are accepted, especially if they are oriented around the sciences. And I couldn't imagine anything better than several million-year-old squid butts being sent to me randomly in the mail. That is really cool. So thank you so much, Jaina. We also have a letter from Jen. And she writes, "Micah, I have a story about something strange in the woods, and I'm sorry if I already shared this, but the monk seal story shared by another listener, which you read last week, reminded me of it." And so Jen's story is as follows. She says, "My family and I have gone to this place in the High Uintas called East Fork of the Bear in order to provide the local scouting community with a mountain man reenactment experience that would teach them skills like wayfinding, starting a fire, and even shooting a black powder percussion rifle. Flintlocks weren't a good option for those who had never shot before, and they require a whole other set of skills. Anyway, we camp in the meadow, a big opening on the main road of camp, and set up teepees and all kinds of baker's tents, which I sleep in. My family sleeps in a teepee. We all gathered around the fire pit and just talking and who knows what at this point, but I looked over at my mom, and she had stopped talking and was staring at something over on one of the ridges just past the shooting range. It was a look of fear and confusion, like her mind couldn't make sense of what she saw. I looked but didn't see anything and asked her if she was okay, and she goes, I saw something and I don't know what it was." Now, she was shaking now and very uncomfortable. Later, she explained that she had seen a dark figure walking upright through the trees, and it went up over the ridge. She said it wasn't a bear because we've seen bears there before. They don't walk like that and aren't that tall. It was missing features for other animals in the area as well. It was strange, and she still doesn't know what it was to this day, although she believes it must have been a Sasquatch. Now, later, I told her about an experience I had a year prior where I had gone up there by myself. I knew most of the guys who were going to be up there and had no worries. Two of them made me set up my baker tent between their teepees, in fact, for safety. Anyway, when I had gotten up there, it was just pouring rain. The ground was so muddy, and there was so much lightning that I wasn't going to set up anything that night, and so I had dinner with my friends and just went to sleep in the truck. Well, it rained a good portion of the night. I was woken up at about 5:30-ish by a very loud, very close howling noise. At first I thought, hey, it's a wolf. I've never seen one in that mountain range, but that doesn't mean that they aren't there. But as I listened, I noticed that there was just one howl. Strange, but again, not unheard of. Then it started to change. It went from wolf to almost like a human kind of a howl, but it wasn't human. Then it went back into a mix of the two. I looked around to see what I could see, but there was nothing. No one else was even awake yet. I was scared and yet curious to know what made the noise. I never even got out of the truck. When it stopped, I noticed that it was dead quiet. No animal sounds at all. A few minutes after that, the noises came back. I have never heard anything like that before or since. That is really interesting, Jen, and thank you for sending that story along. You know, it's kind of funny because while we were there at that festival that I mentioned last week down in Marion, North Carolina, there had been a family there that had come over to talk to us, and the father had said, you know, I think I've seen you on television before, and I want to tell you a story. And so we were talking, and in fact, some of the stories that he shared, one had involved what appeared to be like a fossilized footprint in a human footprint shape, but very large, that was on the ceiling of a cave that they had found. And then the other story involved a set of footprints that they found in deep, fresh snow. Both of these experiences had taken place in the Uintas Mountains that you're describing, Jen. So, you're not the only one to have told me a story about things that have occurred in that area in recent weeks. And having just heard their story, it's a little serendipitous to hear yours now as well. One more listener email I want to get to, and this one again was sent to me weeks ago, and I'm just getting back to it because although I had corresponded with the author of this letter weeks ago already, we'd had a private correspondence about this. I wanted to read his letter here on the show because he's a longtime friend of the program, and also because this is going to serve as the basis for what we're going to be discussing for the remainder of the show. And this one comes to us from a longtime friend and correspondent of the show, Billy Clark, who writes, hey, Micah, I just finished the book Dead Mountain on the Dyatlov Pass incident. And I was quite disappointed by the rushed conclusions, which didn't have a lot of supporting evidence, in my opinion. The author also failed to cross-examine his own theory and seemed to ignore some of the strange occurrences during the case. I was wondering if you have read any better books on the topic and what your conclusions are about the mystery. I guess for me, the conclusion is that it is still very much a mystery, just bizarre goings on. It's hard to think of possible solutions that allow for all of the hikers to behave in such a panic and to apparently become so separated and to perish in such a strange way. The behavior of the Russian authorities throughout is also very peculiar. I heard that earlier in the year the case was to be reopened. Do you know if there is any new information, and will you be covering the mystery again on the show? Well, as you're about to hear, Billy and everyone else, yes, indeed, I will be covering this again on the show. And yes, I think that there is some new information, but one of the problems that we continue to see is that so many different lines of evidence seem to contradict one another. They don't all seem to conform to a single plausible narrative. And so we will spend some time looking at the latest information forthcoming and looking at a number of the theories, weighing the pros and the cons, and looking at what might be most likely with regard to this long-standing mystery. But returning to the email that Billy sent along, he said, the author of the book Dead Mountain is annoyingly dismissive of the UFO possibility, comparing it to considering ghosts, the hand of God, or gnomes as possibilities. Sigh. I think that if you want to explore that theory, there is plenty there to form some ideas. Strange lights were reported in the area after the incident, which may have been related to rocket tests, but as we know, missile sites do seem to be of some interest to UFOs, and therefore the lights seen in the sky do not have to directly correspond to the timing of missile launches themselves. Curious UFO activity could have occurred there at any time. Disregarding the lens flare, the final picture in the camera is of some sort of strange light. Given a torch was found discarded outside the tent, could one of the hikers have been trying to signal it? In some UFO cases, this has been reported as not being a good idea. I can't get away from the idea that something had to be occurring at the front of the tent to necessitate the time and effort taken to make another escape route with a knife. And that, I should note, by the way, is probably one of the most perplexing aspects of this entire mystery. The fact that when investigators arrive at the site of the encampment where the hikers died, they find the tent had been cut open from the inside so that they could escape. What in the world could possibly have been going on? And that's why Billy's arguing, could there have been something going on at the front of the tent? In other words, was the entrance to the tent blocked, which would necessitate cutting another way out of the tent? That's a good question. He goes on to say, if something out of this world were happening outside as a result of some kind of interaction with that light, it might be one of the few things that would explain such a desperate scramble to escape. It seems the radiation on the bodies may not have actually been that strange in terms of level strength, but radiation effects are certainly consistent with some UFO encounters. If there were some kind of pursuit of the hikers, it might explain why, against all experience and reason, they separated, and some were perhaps driven over the ravine, if that does indeed explain their brutal injuries, not convinced given the autopsy data available. Perhaps with the disappearance of the lights and perceived safety, or just a desperate attempt to survive, the remaining hikers tried in vain to return to the tent. Now, I'll add also, there is some evidence that three of the hikers, including Igor Dyatlov himself, made an attempt to get back up the slope to where the tent was, and they failed and did not make it, and hence their bodies were found on the slope in this apparent attempt to get back up there. Billy says, could this all be a case of failed first contact? Also, the missing tongue could be regarded as consistent with cattle mutilation cases. The fact that it isn't thought to have been cut out or ripped out seems to tally with the surgical precision of organ removal in those cattle cases. Whatever happened, it's totally baffling that it would claim all nine of them and that none were able to provide any kind of clue as to what happened in their final moments is hard to accept. Perhaps the investigators were not looking for something like that. A couple of words hastily carved into some wood would have easily been missed. Perhaps we don't have all the available facts. The behavior of the Russian authorities during the case is very peculiar. The strange change of manner of the lead investigator trying to hush up talk of lights in the sky and murder during the case, to later in life insisting that the lights in the sky were directly responsible in some way. I believe that investigator, the chief prosecutor, had been Lev Ivanov, by the way. And that's true. Ivanov basically dismissed a lot of the more extraordinary ideas, the notions that would later become associated with the case. But then decades later, he would say not only that he and his team had observed strange lights in the sky, orbs or disks in the sky around the time of their own investigation, but that they were shut down by higher up authorities and basically told not to talk about it. And so later on, he told newspaper reporters, yeah, I think there was more going on there than meets the eye. Who knows what exactly was going on? Billy concludes, and then there were those zinc-lined coffins. I'd never heard about zinc-lined coffins, though. He says, the hasty termination of the case and strange behavior regarding the funerals could purely be down to panicking authorities who just don't have an answer and need to kill the conversation. But on the other hand, it looks rather like they know more than they are letting on and are feeling guilty about something. Will we ever know? Well, Billy, that is a great question. And I'm with you. I think that probably what's most likely is that this case is really bizarre. The eventual explanation, if it's ever determined, may actually be a lot less bizarre than the case appears to be in the absence of a conclusive solution. And on account of that, it's very possible that authorities just kind of shut things down simply because they didn't have a good explanation and they didn't want there to be too much speculation about what could have happened. And yet, then again, there's also the side of this where if there was something else going on, the authorities' behavior did seem to be consistent with, again, what we might call a cover-up. And many have proposed the idea over the years that there could have been some kind of a military operation during the Soviet era that could have been associated with this. So what did happen to Igor Dyatlov and the other hikers? We will delve into this mystery in depth when we return here on the Micah Hanks program. In Soviet Russia, 9 hikers were mysteriously found dead in February of 1959 under very unclear circumstances. This case remains cold, colder than the mountains where the bodies were found. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program, and we are discussing the Dyatlov Pass incident. This is one of those all-time mysteries. And despite all of the different theories, in fact, I think that there are more than 70 ideas about what could have happened that have been advanced. And yet nothing conclusively accounts for all of the facts. In many ways, I couldn't think of a better example of a modern mystery. And that's why this story has captured our fascination the way that it has. There are some people, many of you guys out there in the listening audience, you're probably like me in the sense that you love to get out in nature. You love to go and hike. There's something about the challenge of being able to get out into nature and face certain extremes. I think it reminds us what we are capable of, what humans evolved to be capable of doing. And long, long ago, our forebears were faced with these kinds of struggles, these kinds of adversities on a daily basis. And if you think of things in those terms, it's really a remarkable time to be alive for humans, where we can choose to put ourselves in harm's way, that we can choose, we can elect to go and put ourselves in harrowing situations that were once a daily part of the lifestyle of our ancestors. We choose to do those things now as a test, as a way of being able to make sure that we haven't lost that grit that helped get humankind in the position that we hold here on planet Earth in the first place. And that certainly drives me. I love to get out there and mountain climb, you know, these sorts of endurance tests. But what the hikers from the Ural Polytechnic Institute in 1959, what they were doing, the test that they were undertaking, is far more extreme than that which most of us, when we go out and we hike on the weekends, would undertake. This was an endurance test only for the most skilled hikers, skiers, or climbers, which they were. And so in February of 1959, when Igor Dyatlov, he's 23 years old at the time, he was a student studying radio engineering there at the Ural Polytechnical Institute, when he and 8 other hikers decide to depart for a skiing expedition across the northern Urals, and they didn't return exactly when they were expected, most people were not overtly concerned. They knew the kinds of conditions there on the mountain. These hikers knew they had to be able to keep their energy levels up. This required warm clothing, high caloric intake, and also things like leaving certain supplies behind. The team had actually left a cache of additional supplies on their way into the region with the intention of retrieving them on the way back. And in that way, they don't have to carry that additional weight in with them. Very experienced hikers and skiers, in other words, they knew the ropes and how best to be able to maintain energy levels and to be able to move quickly and comfortably in otherwise dangerous terrain. Now, each member of this group had actually been what are called grade 2 hikers. They also had ski tour experience, and upon completion of this trip, they would have been awarded grade 3 hiker level, which was the highest level that you could attain in the Soviet Union at that time. So in many ways, you could rightly say that these were among the most experienced hikers and skiers in the Soviet Union at that time. The goal of their expedition had been to reach Otorten, and at the time of year in February that they would attempt this trek, it was considered a Category 3, that of course being the most difficult, so very fitting for the grade level that they were attempting to attain. The group only made it to within 10 kilometers of their destination. As we know, something went horribly wrong. We just don't know what. And hence this remains one of the great mysteries, really, of all time. But earlier this year, there was a development, and CNN broke the story that Russia intended to reopen its investigation into the 60-year-old Dyatlov Pass mystery. Countless articles, books, and documentaries have sought to explain the fate of the group from the Ural Polytechnic Institute, CNN reported. who set off on the trip in 1959 under the direction of Igor Dyatlov, a fifth-year student. The CNN article then compared the Dyatlov incident to many of the great long-standing mysteries of our time, but then continued to note that nobody has so far managed to uncover solid proof of why the group of experienced hikers fled their tents in a remote camping spot while partially clothed and without footwear. Their bodies were discovered over the following weeks in the snow, with several having suffered serious head wounds. Actually, it had been months before some of the bodies would be recovered. And as I noted earlier, the CNN article from February went on to say that some 75 theories have been put forward, according to the prosecutor's office, including an alien abduction. Another suggests that they were killed by members of the Mansi people, those, of course, being the local indigenous tribes, but I doubt that they had anything to do with this, as we will hear a little later. But as the CNN article noted, the new inquiries will only investigate three theories considered the most likely ones. And they quote here from Alexander Kuranovai, who is the official representative of Russia's prosecutor general. And this is what he said during a press conference earlier this year. All of them, the theories, are somehow connected with natural phenomena. Crime is out of the question. There is not a single proof, not even an indirect one, to favor this criminal version. It was either an avalanche, a snow slab, or a hurricane. That's what they said. Relatives, the media, and the public still ask prosecutors to determine the truth and don't hide their suspicions that something was hidden from them. And hence, with the case being reopened in February, investigators are now only exploring these three weather-related possibilities. And hence, I think a question we should rightly ask is, could there be other possibilities worthy of exploration here? We're certainly going to look at a lot of possibilities, and we're going to weigh the knowns against the unknowns. And needless to say, after so many years, there are still an awful lot of unknowns about the Dyatlov Pass incident. But there are many things we do know about this story. And so looking at the facts, we do know that on the morning of January 25, 1959, this group arrives by train at Ivdel in the northern province of Sverdlovsk Oblast. They then travel by truck to a nearby village where they stay the night. And the following morning, they then begin their trek toward Otorten. On January the 28th, second day of their expedition, Yuri Yudin, who had been suffering from severe sciatica and other health ailments, decided that as a result of a flare-up of his sciatic condition, he had to turn back. And that would make Yuri the sole survivor of the original group of hikers. The rest of them decided to continue on, so nine in total head on in the direction of Otorten. Now, at this point, I do want to note something rather unusual, that one of the hikers was overheard saying, while they were still on the train en route to their departure zone. And this is a rather curious character in this entire affair, Semyon Alexeyevich Zolotaryov. He was one of the hikers who, later upon the recovery of his remains, was found having suffered severe chest trauma and his eyes were missing. And Zolotaryov had been heard talking about how they would be remembered for all history. They would essentially be famous once they returned from this hike. And this peculiar proclamation attracted the attention of Vladimir Sungorkin, who's the editor-in-chief of the Komsomolskaya Pravda, and that is a Russian news outlet that has reported rather extensively on this case. And we're going to reference a few articles that they've published even in recent months, because with the reopening of the investigation back in February, as reported by CNN earlier, there's been a lot of renewed interest in the case. Now, one of the things that really makes this case interesting is the fact that these experienced hikers and skiers were keeping records as they traveled. They were keeping logs, journals, they were taking photographs, and all of these materials were recovered by the searchers when they arrived on the scene of the incident. And based on the accounts given in the diaries, based on the photographs that were found on rolls of film inside the cameras that were still there at the camp, they were able to chart, the search and rescue teams, the path that Dyatlov and his company had taken right up until the day before the incident. On the sixth day since they had arrived, this was the 31st of January, the group had made their way to the edge of a highland area where they were making preparations for the ascent that would follow toward O'Torton from there. And there was a wooded valley where they had left these supplies behind. As we mentioned earlier, they left a cache of equipment behind that they could retrieve on their way back out of the region, and that way they were able to lessen their load as they proceeded. The following day, February 1st, the hikers then began their ascent through the pass, which, of course, had not been named at this time. It is now named for the leader of the party, Igor Dyatlov. But poor weather had begun to set in by February 1st, and with heavy snowfall that was making it more and more difficult for the hikers to be able to find their way and see where they were going, experienced though they were, their sense of direction wasn't perfect, and they gradually began to deviate off of course toward the west. And this minor deviation effectively puts them on course for the pinnacle of Cholat Siachol. Now, a few points about this mountain, because there's actually a Wikipedia page for it. And according to that Wikipedia entry, the name of the mountain in the local Mansi language means Dead Mountain. And there are a number of insinuations that have appeared in various literature over the years that these places in the region where these hikers were going had rather ominous names. In addition to Dead Mountain, another location, I think in fact O'Torton, their eventual destination, allegedly in the Mansi language meant don't go there. And that would indeed be rather ominous, would it not? If, of course, it were true. And I want to reference a BBC documentary segment that was aired earlier this summer, titled Dyatlov Pass, in which they interviewed Valery Anyamov, who's a local Mansi tribe leader and a nature reserve worker. And he said the following during this interview with the BBC journalist Lucy Ash. Lots of journalists, he said, have been trying to blow this story up to boost their ratings, and many of them brazenly lie. They take advantage of the fact that we Mansi are few in number, and there aren't enough of us to denounce these rumors. All that stuff about bad places and places of negative energy, that was invented by the mass media. He said, the name of the mountain means mountain with swirling winds. That whole don't go there thing was made up by journalists, or it was a mistranslation. He went on to say, we don't pay much attention because these are fantasies. If any of our people had been involved, they would have thrown us into prison because it was a cruel time, a strict time. People were executed by firing squad without investigation or trial. And this, of course, is in reference to the fact that at the time of the discovery of the bodies, one theory had been that these people had actually been attacked by the local Mansi tribes. And Anyamov went on to say, when they first went missing, they blamed us Mansi. They said we must have killed them, even though the closest Mansi village is 100 kilometers from the Dyatlov Pass. But that's what they decided at the time, and so the Mansi people were arrested and interrogated. He also said that one woman from another village, who's not with us anymore, she's passed away, used to say that the Soviet secret police tortured them. Interrogated, at any rate, the Soviet authorities tried to prove some link for around a month and finally gave up. They then flew their helicopters to our villages and asked for help. And he said, thanks to our guys, the skiers were found. They found some bodies, but it was only with our help that they found the rest. And so on that subject of the discovery of the camp and the bodies, now that we have that bit about the names and what they allegedly mean in the Mansi language behind us, Dyatlov had agreed before he left that he would send a telegram to the sports club back at the Ural Polytechnical Institute as soon as they made their way, he and his group of hikers, back to Vizhai. Now, it was expected that no later than February 12th they would make their way back. And if you recall, Yuri Yudin, who had been the hiker who had to turn back because he was suffering from health problems, Dyatlov told him that, again, by the 12th they should be back. They wouldn't be much longer than that. So the 12th comes and goes. There are no messages received back at the sports club at the Institute. And although, again, people didn't immediately react to this because, well, they are experienced hikers, they may have taken a little longer, you know, we'll wait a couple more days and see what happens, people didn't panic at first. But several more days pass, 8 days, and finally on the 20th of February, many of the family members of the hikers were starting to worry, and they were saying, look, at this point, we need to send an expedition up there. If they're up there still, That's all well and good, but we can't take chances. They are now 8 days overdue. And so, without further hesitation, a search effort was underway, which involved a military presence as well as volunteers from the Institute, fellow classmates of the hikers who were missing. So for this portion of the narrative, I will refer to a St. Petersburg Times article from 2008 on this subject, titled Mysterious Deaths of Nine Skiers Still Unresolved. And this article going to print roughly coinciding with the 49th anniversary of the incident. And the account given here reads as follows. The volunteer rescuers found the abandoned camp on February 26th, so 6 days after the search effort began. And they quote the student who had actually found the tent, who had been assisting with the search. That was Mikhail Sharavin. And he said, quote, "We discovered that the tent was half torn down and covered with snow. It was empty, and all the group's belongings and shoes had been left behind." Investigators said that the tent had been cut open from the inside, as Billy Clark pointed out earlier in his note to us, and they counted traces of footprints from 8 or 9 people in meter-deep snow. The footprints had been left by people who were wearing socks, a single shoe, or were barefoot, and that's one of the great questions about this situation. What could possibly have caused these hikers to have run barefoot out into negative 40 degrees Celsius temperatures in the midst of a snowstorm on the side of that mountain? But now this is key. As the St. Petersburg Times article reports, investigators matched the footprints to the members of the group, saying there was no evidence of a struggle or that other people had entered the camp. And that is key for one primary reason, because as we are looking at all the different theories a little later as to what could have happened to Dyatlov and his companions that night, many have insinuated everything from the idea that they had been attacked by people, that they'd have been attacked by wild animals, and yes, that perhaps Igor Dyatlov and his companions were attacked by a creature that walked on two legs, a Russian wild man, a Yeti. Now, if that were true, if any of those scenarios, ranging from humans to wild animals to a creature purported to exist, which science does not recognize, the Yeti, if any of those things had been involved, then that presents serious problems with the official narrative that investigators were able to match all the footprints that were found in the snow at the time they arrived on the scene to the members of the group. And the only potential discrepancy had been that of the 9 individuals, they were able to account for 8 or 9 footprints. And so while some of the investigators said that they thought that all 9 of the hikers could be accounted for in the spoor, in the footprints that were left in the snow, others had said it looked like there were only 8, and it's possible, therefore, that one of the hikers had been injured and was being carried. That's one interpretation. Needless to say, the footsteps clearly led down the slope toward the forest, but then disappeared after about 500 meters. Returning to the St. Petersburg Times article, Sharavin, the student who had actually found the tent, then found the first 2 bodies at the edge of the forest under a towering pine tree. This was Georgi Krivonoshenko and then Yuri Doroshenko. They were both barefoot and dressed in their underclothes at the time their bodies were found. The article goes on to read that charred remains of a fire lay nearby. The branches on the tree were broken up to 5 meters high, suggesting that a skier had climbed up to look for something. Now, that's another one of the complicators here. Why in the world would these hikers, some of them who are not equipped with the proper footwear, let alone enough clothing to fend against the elements, why would they then climb up into a tree? There was evidence in the form of the breakage of branches. There was even, if memory serves, some human skin found on the branches where the climbing attempt had been made. What could account for them trying to go up the tree? Theories that have been offered about that aspect of this range from them being frightened by something on the ground to the idea proposed by Mikhail Sharavin that they had been crawling up the tree to try and see their way back up the slope and find the location of their original camp. Now, I'll just say this. If there had been anything on the ground that was scaring them up the tree, it hadn't been a wild animal or anything that left footprints because, again, there was no evidence on the ground in the form of spoor that indicated that. There hadn't been any kind of physical threat that was traveling on the ground that would have frightened them badly enough to climb up that tree, so they had to have another reason for going up the tree. although that doesn't rule out the possibility that something perhaps that was not traveling on the ground, if we're to speculate here, nonetheless could have frightened them. Something else could have frightened them. Some other force of nature, perhaps. Something could have frightened them and caused them to crawl up the tree. That is possible. But in any case, what we know is that the branches on that tree were broken up to 5 meters high, and there were also broken branches scattered on the snow below. Now, it's significant, of course, that there were the charred remains of a fire right next to this tree. It could also be that they were going up the tree to try and get branches, since there were some branches laying on the ground, that they could use to feed this fire to try and stay warm. That brings us to the bodies of Dyatlov and two other companions. These next three bodies were found between that tree and back at the primary camp. And the St. Petersburg Times article notes that the way that the bodies were lying, quote, indicated that the three had been trying to return to the camp. The authorities immediately opened a criminal investigation, but autopsies failed to find any evidence of foul play. Doctors said that the five had died of hypothermia. And as far as external injuries found on the bodies of any of the first group of hikers that were discovered, there had really been only one of significance, and that was Rustem Slobodin, 23 years old, found with a fracture to the skull, but it wasn't considered a fatal injury. Well, over the course of the next 2 months, the search continues. The bodies of the remaining skiers were finally found. They were buried under 4 meters of snow in a forest ravine, and this ravine 75 meters away from the pine tree where the apparent bonfire had been built and also evidence of climbing up that tree had been found. And these four hikers appeared to have suffered traumatic deaths. And the discovery of these hikers, this portion of the broader investigation into the Dyatlov Pass incident, presents some of the most disturbing and also the most peculiar in terms of what the investigators would find. What could account for the bizarre nature of the injuries this group of hikers sustained? We will look into that and more when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. It is one of the greatest mysteries in Russian history, if not all of the world, why 9 experienced cross-country skiers left their tent on a frosty slope in the Ural Mountains in the middle of the night, leaving behind food, warm coats, and other supplies that they required in order to survive. None of them survived the ordeal. What happened to Igor Dyatlov and his companions in February of 1959. We will continue to explore this in a moment. I do want to remind you, if you enjoy this program and you would like to support us and get a little something to show for it, the best way you can do that is to sign up, become an X subscriber. It's easy to do. Just head over to MicahHanks.com/podcast and click subscribe to X in the upper right hand corner. You can also head over to GraylianReport.com/X and sign up there. That will get you additional weekly podcasts, monthly specials like Enigmas, and much more for only $7 a month or $77 a year. So definitely consider supporting this program and becoming a subscriber to the X Podcasts. Lots more to enjoy from yours truly and the Graylian Gang. And allow me to remind you, of course, if you head over to GraylianReport.com, GraylianReport.com, we have additional articles and news that comes out each week. You can also find past episodes of this podcast there, in addition to at my website, MicahHanks.com. Lots of content that we provide. We hope you guys enjoy all of it. And we, of course, appreciate all of you who show support for this program. The many of you who send along news tips, stories, emails, and things like that. It's tough work, but you guys, every one of you out there, make it all worthwhile. And I can't thank you enough, but I'll thank you anyway. So thank you. And getting back into this story, I want to share a rather poignant quote from Yuri Yudin, who you'll remember had been the hiker who was suffering from sciatica and other issues, and he turns back one day before the rest of the crew head off in the direction of their ultimate fate. And he said, if I had a chance to ask God one question, just one question, it would be, what really happened to my friends that night? We still don't know. After 60 years, we still are no closer, really, to any answer. Although a new investigation, which was reopened just this year, is seeking to try and understand what could have happened. And looking at all the possibilities, laying all of them on the table, the mystery of the Dyatlov Pass incident is as perplexing as ever. Now, in the last segment, I had mentioned a BBC report on this from earlier this summer. I want to share a few quotes, and this was provided to Lucy Ash, who was the reporter for the BBC, by Sasha, her guide, who took her back to the location where many of the hikers spent their final night there on the mountain. And at one point, Sasha says to Lucy, it doesn't seem like a sensible place for a tent when they could have gone down into the valley by the river, where they would have been able to find water and wood for their fire. And many have raised this question, why in the world did they camp out there on the middle of that slope in these extremely adverse conditions? And Sasha says, maybe they had climbed up this far and they didn't want to lose height, but it does seem like a strange place for an experienced group to camp. Another theory about why they may have camped where they camped, in addition to not wanting to lose altitude, had been that they might have just wanted to practice camping in adverse conditions. I mean, after all, they were going for that third grade, the highest you could attain in the Soviet Union at that time, and they felt that they were well equipped to be able to camp in a location like that, despite the inclement conditions, so it could have been a training exercise that ultimately led to their fate. And as we've heard, many of the bodies, including that of Igor Dyatlov, had been found. It was a couple of months before the other bodies were eventually located. And before we describe their discovery and their condition at the time of their discovery, I want to return again to Mikhail Sharavin, who had been one of the students at the Polytechnical Institute who had been one of the searchers and who had actually found the tent and the first group of bodies. Because Sharavin was also interviewed during the BBC documentary earlier this summer. And in that documentary, Sharavin also described the condition of the tent and what he found inside when he discovered it. And he said, near the tent, the main tent where they'd all been camping, that if you recall, they had cut their way out of. He said, near the tent, we saw frozen footprints. They looked as if they were made by people wearing socks or barefoot. There was only one boot print, so they must have left the tent half-dressed, and the tracks continued for 5 to 10 meters, and they disappeared, and sometimes we saw a few footprints further down the slope. Our first thought, when we found the tent, was to find out if there were any people in there, but there was no one. How could they still be alive somewhere when they had left like that, barefoot and in socks? We were shocked. He said, we sat down at the camp for a meal. I suggested we open a flask of spirits we found in the tent and proposed a toast for the Dyatlov group. We drank it, and a guy named Pashin said that we'd better not drink to their health, but to their eternal peace. Evidently, even at that early stage during the search, it didn't look very good. Over the course of the next 6 days, the searchers continued to try and find further evidence of what might have happened and where the remains might lay. And Sharavin notes that we approached the cedar tree on the 6th day. He said, when we were about 20 meters away, we saw a brown spot. It was toward the right of the tree, and when we got closer, we saw that there were two corpses lying there. Their hands and feet were brown. It was very striking, and closer to the tree, we saw the remains of a campfire. Now, the remaining bodies, like I mentioned, had been found only with the coming of the warmer weather, and these members of the Dyatlov party had suffered skull fractures. There was crushing force that had been applied to the chest. Missing organs. One hiker's eyes were missing, as we mentioned earlier. Another hiker, whose name was Dubinina, apparently had had her tongue removed. And we return now to the St. Petersburg Times article from 2008. They say it took 2 months to locate those remaining skiers. The bodies were buried under 4 meters of snow in a forest ravine 75 meters away from the pine tree. The bodies, however, showed no external wounds, despite the missing organs on some of the bodies and also the severe trauma to the bodies. But these four were better dressed than the rest, and those who had died first had apparently relinquished their clothing to the others. Zolotaryov was wearing Dubonina's faux fur coat and her hat, while Dubonina's foot was wrapped in a piece of Krivonoshenko's wool pants. Now this leads us to another peculiarity that has raised many questions about the Dyatlov Pass incident over the years, because this group of hikers found 75 meters away and having suffered all of these injuries had been wearing more clothing, much of it borrowed from those who probably had not fared so well against the cold that night. Much of the clothing, in other words, had probably been borrowed from their fallen companions, and as they attempt to try and make their way away from the site, and whatever specifically led them to go down into this ravine remains unclear, but they have more clothing on them, and tests of the clothing appears to have shown that they contained high levels of radiation. Now, more on that in a moment, but according to the St. Petersburg Times article, the investigation was closed after just a few months, and investigators say that they couldn't find anyone to accuse of wrongdoing. Case files were sent to a secret archive. Skiers and other adventurers were barred from the area for 3 years. And that brings us to Yuri Kuntsevich, who is now the head of the Ekaterinburg-based Dyatlov Foundation. He was interviewed by the BBC in the documentary this summer, but he also was quoted in the St. Petersburg Times. You'll see his name show up quite a lot in relation to this investigation. And he will always tell this particular story about how at the age of 12, he had actually lived in the town where some of the funerals took place. And so attending the funerals, he described the following. He said, "When I was 12 years old, I went to the funerals of this group. I lived on the same street as the cemetery. There were rumors flying all over the city that these students had wandered into some kind of tests or experiments." And this is what he had to say to Lucy Ash during the BBC documentary earlier this summer. He said, "The coffins were open, and I could see that the skin on their faces was a weird color, the color of bricks. But this was only something people talked about in their kitchens. There was nothing about it in the newspapers. Some people saw this as some kind of state secret." He said, "My brother took me to the Ural Polytechnic Institute and registered me in the hiking club. We went on lots of hikes and trips, and every year we used to go and put flowers on their memorial, up on the pass in their memory." He said, "I talked with the students that had known Dyatlov, and they believed that there had been an explosion of some kind." Which leads to the inevitable question, well then, what might have exploded? Now, the St. Petersburg Times, in their article, had reported the following very peculiar information. They said, in 1990, the chief investigator, Lev Ivanov, said in an interview that he had been ordered by senior regional officials to close the case and classify the findings as secret. He said that the officials had been worried by reports from multiple eyewitnesses, including the Weather Service and the military, that bright flying spheres had been spotted in the area in February and March of 1959. We have the following quote about this from Ivanov. He said, "I suspected at the time and am almost sure now that these bright flying spheres had a direct connection to the group's death." Now, Ivanov had initially given that statement to the Leninsky Put, which is a small Kazakh newspaper. The St. Petersburg Times reported in 2008 that, quote, "the declassified files contain testimony from the leader of a group of adventurers who camped about 50 kilometers south of the skiers on the same night. And here is what he said that he and his group saw, that they had seen, quote, strange orange spheres floating in the night sky in the direction of Holat Siakol." Ivanov speculated that one skier might have left the tent during the night, seen a sphere, and woken up the others with his cries. Ivanov said that the sphere might have exploded as they ran toward the forest, killing the four who had serious injuries and cracking Slobodin's skull. Now, Yuri Yudin, the sole survivor because he hadn't joined his companions on their ordeal, Yudin said that he also thought an explosion had killed his friends. He said that the level of secrecy surrounding the incident suggests that the group might have inadvertently entered a secret military testing ground. He said that the radiation on the clothes supported his theory. Kuntsevich agrees. He says that another clue to the deaths was the fact that the faces of the first five bodies had been inexplicably tan, if you recall when he was 12 years old attending the funerals, and he said that their skin was just extraordinarily brown. Yudin also said that the released documents contained no information about the condition of the skier's internal organs. However, Yudin says, and I quote, "I know for sure that there were special boxes with their organs sent for examination." There'll be more to say about that point a little later, but I want to return to a few of the more unusual quotes that were provided to the BBC earlier this summer. And the first comes from Valery Anyamov, who had been the local Mansi tribe leader that was interviewed. And here is what he had to say about his theory as to what might have actually happened. He said, "I'm interested in what caused their deaths, but I'm not sure about the cause. I lean toward more of a technological explanation that there was some portion of a rocket that fell off and poisoned the Dyatlov group." Now, Anyamov also appeared on camera earlier this month in September in a short segment that was produced by RT, Russian state-sponsored media, right? And in that documentary, Anyamov appeared on camera and said, quote, "Perhaps the stage of a rocket came down, and that caused panic, and the students ran down the mountain. As they were asleep already in the tent, as the rocket stage fell, they ran away in fear." Now, why in the world would they think a rocket had anything to do with this? Apart from the fact, of course, that Lev Ivanov, the chief investigator, in the 1990s came out and talked about the fact that he and other investigators during their investigation shortly after the incident had seen these orange spheres in the region. Other hikers in the region around that time said that they had seen them. There were a lot of reports of these kinds of things. Well, there was something else that was unusual that was reported by Valery Anyamov's mother. And he actually said, "There was a story my mother told me, which could be rather moot, but this is the story that she gave the BBC during their reporting on this earlier this summer." Apparently, Valery's mother had been alive at the time of the incident, and that one evening she had been outside collecting firewood when she said she noticed something strange in the sky. And she said, I quote, "We were coming back from the forest and we could see the village when this bright burning object appeared. It was wider at the front and narrower at the back with a tail, and there were sparks flying off it, and it passed over the village, and people from the neighboring village saw it as well." We return now to Valery, her son, and he said, "The old people said it was something that caused illnesses, something that was harmful to people." Now, that is a really weird account, and yes, what she describes does sound vaguely reminiscent of some sort of a rocket. And to that point, the St. Petersburg Times reported that, quote, "While a missile fired from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan could have reached the northern Urals, there were no records of launches that occurred at that time, and that according to Alexander Zeleznyakov, a historian on Soviet missiles and a senior official with the Korolyov Rocket and Space Corporation, Energia. The Soviet Union's other main launch pad, Plesetsk, only opened in late 1959, which, of course, was several years after the Dyatlov incident occurred. Zeleznyakov also said that the surface-to-air missiles that could have been launched from the pads had not yet been built. And so the Defense Ministry and the Yekaterinburg Regional Prosecutor's Office said that they had no immediate information citing the age of the case. But that brings us back to Kuntsevich, who at age 12 had been there and seen some of the bodies at the cemetery where the funeral was held, which puts him on this lifelong quest to try and get to the bottom of whatever might have gone down. He claimed that in 2007, he took a group of people to the area where the camp that Igor Dyatlov and his companions had made on their final night there on the mountain. They went back to the site, and he said that they found a cemetery of scrap metal there at the location that suggested the military had conducted experiments there at some time. He said, "We can't say what kind of military technology was tested, but the catastrophe of 1959 was man-made." Now, Yuri Yudin also seems to share this attitude. He said, and I quote, that the military might have found the tent before the volunteer rescuers. He said he had been asked to identify the owner of every object found at the scene, and he said he had failed to find a match for a piece of cloth that looked like it had come from a soldier's coat. He also said that there had been a pair of glasses that were found at the location, and also a pair of skis and a piece of a ski that did not seem to belong to any of the actual hikers, and that these objects could not be explained if they didn't belong to those individuals who had put them there, and how could they have gotten there before the primary investigators were on site. Yudin further had said in 2008 that he had also seen documents that led him to believe that the criminal investigation had been opened on February 6th, which is significant because that's 14 days before the search team claimed that they had found the tent. And so what does all of that mean? Well, Kuntsevich, who has spent his entire life studying this, has come to the following conclusion, and this is what he told the BBC earlier this summer. He said, nobody can be 100% sure. Maybe they died on the spot because they were victims of some kind of experiment, and then it was staged to make it look as though they froze to death. Look, they died and were kept in a morgue, but then military command showed up and said, this is an emergency and we need to get rid of the bodies. So they loaded them all up and sent a search party to go look for them and make it seem like they froze to death. Now, I have a lot of problems with Kosinovich's conclusions because, again, he is asserting a conspiracy theory that there was some sort of a incident, that there was a big cover-up, and it was made to look like they'd all died of semi-natural causes, because there are certainly some aspects of this that seem quite unnatural, at very least in terms of the things that you would expect to find where a group of hikers were exposed to the elements and died of hypothermia. Again, the removal of organs, internal injuries without any kind of external damage, all of the weird aspects of this case. They don't seem to be easily accounted for, but to propose that the Soviets had actually gone up there and laid the bodies out and made it look like something other than what it actually was, that really strains credulity. I mean, how in the world would they have covered up their own footprints, for instance? I just don't know about that. Although I am rather intrigued, I'll say, by Yuri Yudin's allegation that there had been belongings recovered from the camp that didn't seem to belong to some of the hikers. But even that may have an explanation. Now, another individual who has researched this, and in fact, a guy who's written, I think, three books, if not more, on this subject, is Aleik Alapayov. And he also was interviewed by the BBC earlier this summer. And he talked about how Lev Ivanov, who years later comes out and says, yes, my own team and I and others who we interviewed had seen these orange orbs around the time. Alapayov gave the following statement to the BBC about Ivanov and his own investigations. He said that Ivanov, the lead prosecutor, began to work on this case very enthusiastically. His daughter told me he was very experienced and worked hard trying to understand everything. During the investigation, he asked the forensic expert about the causes of the severe physical traumas. And this, of course, mostly evident with those final three hikers that were found 70-some meters away. He was told it was something like an explosion went off. Here again we have this insinuation that something akin to an explosion occurred up there on the mountain. Alapayov goes on to say, after this, Ivanov shouldn't have closed the case, but he was under pressure to do so, and the authorities tried to prevent information from spreading. Many sources have said this over the years, by the way, including Ivanov himself. In those days, Alapayov goes on to say, opposing the party meant not only the end of your career. That was unfortunately the reality for our country. It meant more than just, you don't get to work anymore. If you opposed the party, you went away. They would take you off someplace and you would never be seen again. And so essentially when Ivanov was told the case is being closed, there wasn't anything he could really do about it. And hence the information doesn't come out until the 1990s, many years later after the fall of the Iron Curtain, do we start seeing attitudes loosen up a little bit about this. Well, as we've already addressed, Ivanov later admitted to a newspaper that he not only had seen strange things in the sky, balls of light, but he had also been amazed by some of those autopsy results, and he had been ordered to classify all of his findings to forget about them. He even goes on to apologize later to the families for lying about the truth. Alapayov has uncovered a lot of odd clues as to what he believes happened to those victims, and that brings us back to that unique point from earlier about the radiation found on the hikers' clothing, and this is what Alapayov has to say about that. He said, the first autopsies took place in a little morgue, and representatives of the KGB, not the local police, surrounded it, and they didn't let anyone in. The atmosphere was very serious, and a big barrel of alcohol was delivered. And that suggests that before the autopsy, some people knew the bodies were contaminated. Now, he said, admittedly, it's a primitive form of protection from radiation. It's one thing just bringing small containers of alcohol to store small fragments of organs. Remember, we touched on how Yuri Yudin had said that he knew that organs had been removed and taken off for testing. Well, Alapayov essentially says the same thing. He says it's one thing just to bring small containers of alcohol to store fragments of organs, but they were given clear instructions to wipe themselves all over with alcohol, to rub it all over their naked bodies after the autopsy. This was the whole point, he said. Such measures never normally took place in those days. It was without precedent. He said, geographically, this area is huge, and at the time of the deaths, many animals and birds were found dead, and local people were banned from using water from the wells. They had to bring in water from elsewhere. He said, these are known facts. And what he's implying there is that there had been, at very least, the belief that there was possible contamination. His interpretation of the fact that people weren't allowed to go up there and hunt, and that water couldn't be drawn from wells, was concern over this contamination, further evidenced, he believed, by the large quantities of alcohol being brought in, that these people who had conducted the autopsies were essentially sterilizing themselves afterward. And Lucy Ash, in the BBC documentary from earlier this summer, also says that indeed some of the local Mansi had confirmed that their reindeer herds were banned from the area, and that hunting hadn't been allowed in the region for about 4 years. Now, coming back to the autopsies, Alep Hayov said that, quote, in the autopsy reports, it mentions that fragments of the internal organs from the first 5 bodies were sent for chemical analysis. He said there's a signed paper, and this paper he's referencing appears to have been released in some of the documents that were later declassified about this a number of years ago. He says that there's a signed paper, quote, saying the organs were successfully delivered and were stored in a fridge. What happened after that? I had to investigate for myself, and I learned that 2 chemists conducted the analysis. And as soon as the results were known, some people came and took the organs away along with the paperwork. Today, he says, I don't exclude the possibility that the problem fell from the sky, meaning there was an explosion. It's impossible to say whether it was a military rocket, but why did the young people leave their tent in such a hurry? Because they couldn't breathe, perhaps? Maybe they were affected by poisonous rocket fuel. So there, in essence, is the rocket theory that has been proposed, one and the same, in many minds, to that of the idea of orbs or UFOs seen around that time. But we're going to look at some of the other theories with regard to the Dyatlov Pass incident when we return right after this here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program, probing one of the great mysteries of all time, the Dyatlov Pass incident. And with a new investigation underway currently that is reinvestigating this long-standing mystery, there are so many questions that remain, so many theories, more than 70, that have been offered over the years. But what's really going on here? And that's what we're trying to get to the bottom of, as so many have tried in the past to do. And in terms of the inquest files that have been released, the portions that have been made available to the public, which journalists have reported on, these are some of the things that we do know. 6 of the group members died of hypothermia and 3 of fatal injuries. There were also no indications, footprints or otherwise, that appeared to show that there had been other people nearby on Kholak Siakal, apart from the 9 travelers. Now, there had been other hikers in other regions nearby, but they weren't in the immediate vicinity. Some of those hikers had also claimed to have seen orange orbs, lights in the sky, things like that. The tent that Dyatlov and his company had been using for their campsite had been ripped open from within. The victims had died 6 to 8 hours after their last meal. Traces from the camp showed that all of the group members left the campsite of their own accord and on foot, and this is rather strange, too. The stride and the footprints seem to also show that rather than fleeing in a mad panic, it actually looks more like they had just walked, like they had left on foot of their own accord, some of them barefoot, most of them underdressed for the occasion, but nonetheless that they hadn't just fled and panicked. There were deliberate footsteps, and that's also odd. There were high levels of radiation found on at least one victim's clothing. We can also pretty safely rule out any kind of involvement by the local Mansi tribes. In fact, the injuries found on three of the bodies, they say, could not have been caused by another human being. In fact, they had determined that the force of the blows had been too strong, there was no soft tissue that had been damaged, only internal injuries, and no evidence of exterior injury that would be akin to bludgeoning or something if they'd been attacked by a person or an animal. Now, despite the fact that there had been some rather anomalous injuries, the released documents themselves didn't seem to contain any information about the actual condition of the skier's internal organs. And of course, there were no survivors to the incident. But there are plenty of theories about what could have happened. And so now I want to look at a few of those. One of those involves a katabatic wind. And this had been proposed just this year by a Swedish-Russian expedition that was made to the site. And after investigations, they proposed that a violent katabatic wind is a likely explanation for the incident. This is essentially a rare kind of meteorological phenomenon where an extremely violent wind appears. There was a similar case that occurred in Sweden back in 1978, and under similar conditions, eight hikers died in the aftermath of a katabatic wind. And the Swedish-Russian expedition members noted that the topography of both the location in Sweden and there at the Dyatlov Pass were noted to be very similar. And in their mind, if a sudden katabatic wind had appeared, they say it would have made it very difficult, maybe impossible, for Dyatlov and his crew to remain in the tent. And therefore, the most rational course of action for them to have taken would have been to cover the tent with snow and seek shelter among the tree line. In other words, they were the ones that actually piled the snow on top of the tent, which was the condition under which it was found when the search teams arrived. They would have done this to keep the wind from blowing the tent away while they tried to take shelter among the trees further down the slope. And the proponents of the katabatic wind theory further argue one unique piece of evidence. They say that there had been a flashlight that had been left turned on top of the tent, and that they thought that maybe this would be used by the hikers to find their way back up there to the tent. This might also explain the reason that they had climbed, one of them apparently, up the tree where they had built the fire, as though they were trying to look back up the slope. They might have been looking to make sure that their tent hadn't been blown away. That also brings us to the idea of infrasound, and this, of course, is the theory that was proposed by Donny Eicher in 2013 in the book that Billy Clark had written to me about, Dead Mountain. And the infrasound hypothesis has never really resonated very well with me. This theory essentially entails that as a result of the shape of the slope where the incident occurred, that the winds coursing along it might have actually caused a peculiar infrasound phenomena. That infrasound was generated by the wind as it passed over the top of the mountain, and that this would have resulted in disorientation and physical discomfort among the hikers, which caused them to become confused, disoriented. They run down the slope, many of them experiencing inexplicable fear as a result of this infrasound. And once they make their way down there to the tree line, they're regaining their composure because they're out of the range of the alleged infrasound. They realize, my gosh, we just ran in a blind panic out of our tent in the middle of the night and we're stuck down here in our underwear. What are we going to do now? We, of course, see that Igor and two of his companions tried to make their way back up to the tent and failed. But to me, the infrasound theory doesn't account for a number of the other factors. How does the infrasound theory account for some of the injuries sustained by the hikers? I think this is the same problem that Agent Billy Clark had when he wrote to me about it, and I'm right there with you, Billy. That just doesn't make sense to me. The infrasound theory, like a lot of theories that have been proposed, doesn't seem to account for all of the factors in this case. But I should point out on that note that the fact that there were lights seen in the sky, the fact that some of the local Mansi tribe had claimed that they had seen something that was producing sparks as it passed through the sky, something they believed caused illnesses. In other words, some of these quote-unquote UFO sightings occurring around the time in that general area, they may not be linked to what happened to Dyatlov and his party either. And that's one area where we really need to be careful. Many researchers who'd been looking into this thought that the orbs of light that were being seen around that time had something to do with it, but I don't think that any of them were saying that they thought that UFOs had dropped down, that they were trying to make contact, or that there'd been an abduction, as some have proposed. I think they were all looking at the lights in the sky as being possibly related to some kind of Soviet weapons test, something involving the military, and hence why they believed that there had been a cover-up. Now, there's another interesting theory that's been proposed also, which is paradoxical undressing. And this had apparently been proposed in the International Science Times. Although there is such a thing, and in fact, with a lot of the so-called missing 411 occurrences here in North America and abroad, one of the reasons why hikers who become disoriented and are found farther off the trail than you'd expect, and sometimes they're missing articles of clothing, this can be as a result of this so-called paradoxical undressing. And in some instances where a hiker begins to experience the onset of hypothermia, they may begin to perceive that they are experiencing intense feelings of heat rather than the frigid cold, which is conducive to the hypothermia itself. And as these stages of disorientation begin to set in, they may begin to remove clothing as they are actually suffering from hypothermia as a result of the misinterpretation of feelings of burning warmth when they're actually freezing. So that's something that had been proposed. But again, like the infrasound theory, to me, paradoxical undressing simply doesn't account for all of the aspects of what seems to be going on there with the Dyatlov hikers. Now, although the balls of light theory is essentially addressed with regard to the ideas about a military connection to all of this, I want to come back to that one for a moment because there was this brief entry entitled The Enigma of the Fireballs. That was the actual title of an article that had been written in the 1990s by Lev Ivanov, who had been the lead prosecutor in the original investigation. And then he is essentially shut down. He has to remain quiet for a number of decades in the 1990s when he comes out and he starts talking about some of the odd things he noticed during this investigation. He began to write about those fireballs. And this is a quote from Ivanov in his article, The Enigma of the Fireballs. He wrote, "When E.P. Maslenikov and I examined the scene in May, and this presumably of 1959, we found that some young pine trees at the edge of the forest had burn marks, but those marks did not have a concentric form or some other pattern. There was no epicenter." Ivanov said this once again confirmed that heated beams of a strong but completely unknown, at least to us, energy were directing their firepower towards specific objects, in this case people, acting selectively. That is indeed a rather interesting statement, especially taking into account the fact that he said that he and some of his other investigators and many others that they had spoken with throughout the region, and as we heard in the BBC documentary, quoted from a Mansi woman who had been alive at the time, she too and others claimed that they had all seen strange lights in the sky, objects, orbs, something along those lines. And for that reason, there is another theory that many times over the years I have brought attention to. I'm certainly not the only one. Keep in mind, there are around 75 theories that have been proposed as to what could have happened at Dyatlov Pass in 1959. But one that I have maybe not married myself to, but certainly I've given consideration to, is the idea of some kind of Earth-like phenomena, something akin to ball lightning. And one reason I have often thought that ball lightning could be something that should be given consideration in relation to the Dyatlov Pass mystery involves a very curious report that I found in the British Journal of Meteorology that appeared back in 1984. And it reads as follows. "I woke up with a strange feeling that a stranger had made his way into our tent. Thrusting my head out of the sleeping bag, I froze. A bright yellow blob was floating about 1 meter from the floor. It disappeared into Korovin's sleeping bag," this one of the companions of the narrator in this instance. "The man screamed in pain. The ball jumped out and proceeded to circle over the other bags, now hiding in one, now in another. When it burned a hole in mine, I felt an unbearable pain, as if I were being burned by a welding machine and blacked out." Now, if it isn't already evident what is being described there, he is saying that this yellow orb of light has appeared inside the tent with he and the other hikers in this instance. And the narrator says that the thing went into his companion Korovin as though it passed right through him. He screamed in agony, and then the thing comes out and it does the exact same thing to him, and he blacks out. He says, "Regaining consciousness after a while, I saw the same yellow ball which, methodically observing a pattern that was known to it alone, kept diving into the bags, evoking desperate, heart-wrenching howls from the victims. The indescribable horror repeated itself several times. When I came back to my senses for the fifth or sixth time, the ball was gone. I could not move my arms or legs, and my body was burning as if it had turned into a ball of fire itself. So he goes on to conclude that at the hospital where we were flown by helicopter, 7 wounds were found on my body. They were worse than burns. Pieces of muscle were found to be torn out of the bone. The same happened to Shingen, Kaprov, and Bashkirov. Oleg Korovin, the man who he described earlier, had been killed by the ball, possibly because his bag had been on a rubber mattress, insulating it from the ground. The ball lightning did not touch a single metal object, injuring only people. Now, that story definitely sounds a lot like the Dyatlov Pass incident, considering that, again, we have internal injuries that are sustained as a result of this ball lightning passing through individuals. It manifests inside of their tent. Why these guys didn't try to escape or cut their way out, why they just laid there and let this ball lightning pass through them like he describes, although he does say that he kept passing out as a result of this, but one of the men is actually killed by this thing. Now, I've never found any additional corroborative information about this report that helps us determine whether it really happened, who the individuals were that it happened to, you know, anything else about this report that gives us any clear indication of what exactly we are dealing with, what we're hearing, what they're talking about right there. But it is an interesting report, and one of two things might be going on there. It could be that what we're hearing is a story that was inspired by interpretations of what might have happened at Dyatlov Pass in 1959, or indeed it could be describing something similar, which remains a possible explanation for what might have happened to Igor Dyatlov and his company. And it really does kind of make you wonder, could it have been that there were circumstances, or maybe that in an extremely cold environment, perhaps in that part of the world, again, noting the similarity between the locations, the Dyatlov party in the Urals, these men were reportedly in the Caucasus. Could there be something geologically about that part of the world where under those circumstances, whatever they may be, geologically or environmentally, that something like ball lightning might be able to manifest, and more importantly, that it could actually manifest inside of a tent or a sleeping bag? It's an interesting conjecture, and one of the many theories that has been proposed about what could have happened at Dyatlov Pass. But those we've named here are certainly not the only theories, and although there is another I would like to touch on which I find to be highly unlikely, I'm interested in it because of some of the cultural beliefs in that region which are suggestive of a cryptozoological component to this. Is that a likely explanation for what happened at Dyatlov Pass? I don't think so, but I think it nonetheless warrants mention, the idea of an abominable snowman, when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Back. It is the Micah Hanks program, the final segment of this week's edition. And where we left off, there had been the insinuation made a few years ago by a rather notorious documentary that appeared on Discovery, which attempted to link the Dyatlov Pass incident to the existing traditions among the Mansi people of a wild man, the Russian Yeti, in other words. Now, I have been a critic of that idea for a number of years, and I'll tell you why. First of all, a lot of the evidence upon which this is based is pretty flimsy, but nonetheless, there are some connections. One had been the fact, as we noted near the beginning of our exploration into this subject, the Dyatlov hikers were documenting their expedition, both in logs and journals, and also on film. And so I think part of what makes this story kind of eerie is the fact that we have so many photographs. They're like ghosts, each one, because we see these people days and in some instances hours before they met their ultimate demise there on that mountain. But we have a lot of photographs documenting their experiences. And in one instance, one of the last photographs on a roll of film in one of the cameras showed a humanoid figure off in the distance in the forest. And although that is legitimate, there is an actual photograph that depicts a humanoid figure that's really too grainy and indistinct off in the distance in the forest on black and white film like this to really be able to make out any details. I think it is that ambiguity that is fed into the mythos that this could be a Russian wild man, which was, to my knowledge, first posited in this Discovery documentary. I don't think anyone had ever looked at this photograph and gone, wait a minute, what in the world is that? Until this documentary, which presents this rather sensational idea of a Russian wild man, a Yeti, airs on television. And in truth, I'm not sure that they ever would have looked at that photograph, that ambiguous photograph of a figure off in the distance, and said, well, that could be a Yeti, if it hadn't been for the additional fact that the hikers in the logs and journals that they'd been keeping had mentioned the Yeti, the Russian wild man. But in order to interpret this correctly, we've got to understand the context. Because as sort of an inside joke between the hikers leading up to their expedition, they actually had been keeping journals, and they'd even gone so far as to produce a little kind of mock newspaper about the region that they were headed to, which is really funny if you think about it in terms of the fact that this is a very desolate region. The Mansi people, they don't have newspapers, right? They live very simply out there in the sticks. And so the idea of there being a newspaper about this community where there was none, that was part of the joke. And one of the stories, quote-unquote, that appeared in their little newspaper was one about scientific studies of the abominable snowman, the wild men up there in that area. You also have to keep in mind that only a couple of years prior to the Dyatlov incident had it become big news over in the United States, right around Northern California, the discovery of massive footprints in Bluff Creek by a guy named Jerry Crew, a construction foreman. And this had caused a number of researchers who were already interested in the idea of the abominable snowman of the Himalayas and surrounding regions. They had now begun to swarm around Northern California looking for a North American counterpart to the Eurasian wild man known as the abominable snowman. This was all big news there in the middle to late 1950s, and so no doubt that would have been something that a group of students probably would have been joking about at that time, it having been in the news. And so in their little newspaper, part of the log that they kept in advance of this expedition, they were talking about wild man sightings in the region. That doesn't mean that there were really wild man sightings. They very well may have actually been interested in that subject, but they were kind of having fun with it. Nonetheless, these things form the basis for this Discovery documentary from a few years ago, which had a rather sensational title, Russian Yeti, The Killer Exists. Now, about that photograph. The photograph, if you actually look at all of the photographs on that roll of film, as I have looked at, you can see them all online, in sequence. Quite obviously, the photographer had set a timer on his camera to take several pictures, and in successive photographs leading up to the photo of the figure off in the distance, you see him walking away from the camera. In other words, the mysterious subject off in the distance is quite obviously the photographer himself, using a timer to take photographs of himself off in the woods. But taken out of context, the photograph looks a lot more mysterious by itself. And that's the problem with television these days. You really have to take with a grain of salt things that people present as quote-unquote evidence that a Russian Yeti went up there and killed those hikers. But if it makes so little sense to insinuate something like that, why then do we want to talk about that right now? Why would I even have interest in that? Well, the reasons are twofold, because I think, A, it's important to point out that the documentary in question had taken some serious liberties with its interpretation of some of the facts about the case, which presents a narrative that, although has some basis in reality, is not a correct interpretation based on the facts. And further, there is really no evidence, in light of all this, that there was any kind of a Yeti connection with Dyatlov past. We don't need to go there in terms of trying to understand what might have actually happened to those hikers, what tragedy could have led to the loss of life that we saw there in 1959. But the other reason is because of this. If you go to the Wikipedia page for the Dyatlov Pass incident, you'll actually see one of the headings under the listing of different hypotheses as to what might have happened. You'll see one of the headings that reads pseudoscientific theories. And they say, I'm going to read, the 2014 Discovery Channel special, Russian Yeti, The Killer Lives, explored the theory that the Dyatlov group was killed by a mink or a Russian Yeti. Mink simply being the name that the Mansi have in their cultural traditions. Yes, that's right. They actually do have traditions that involve the belief that a wild man exists, which bears a number of similarities to similar wild men alleged to exist in other parts of the world. For instance, the mink, they say, you always know it's coming because you'll hear it whistling. And this is a tradition that is held among many of the Pacific Northwestern Native American tribes as well. They'll often talk about Zawanka and other iterations of wild people in their mythology that whistle. And the traditions often maintain that children need to be brought in if that whistling noise is heard, because the wild men and women often come and take away children. This is a common motif in these mythologies. And I would agree that it's highly pseudoscientific to insinuate that there's some legitimacy to the idea of the wild men thing in relation to the Dyatlov Pass incident. But on the other side of that, I also cringe a little when I see the academic interpretation that any and all discussion of alleged relict hominoids, creatures that resemble humans but which are more primitive, along the lines of your Sasquatch, Yeti, etc., the idea that that discussion should be excluded and relegated exclusively to the realm of pseudoscience bothers me a little. And here's one reason why. There's a book that's not very well known today, but I guess when it came out in 1983, it kind of made a splash in the cryptozoological community and the anthropological community. It was written by an archaeologist named Myra Shackley, and there were actually two versions of the book. Now, one was titled Wild Man, but then there was another version that was titled Still Living. I think they changed the title probably in order to remove some of the stigma that almost inevitably becomes attached to a book on this subject. But here was a unique instance in 1983 where you have a young, talented British archaeologist who has done her field work in Russia, and she is convinced that there is something more to the stories that people tell in this part of the world about these alleged wild men. And the subtitle of the book actually is Yeti, Sasquatch, and the Neanderthal Enigma. And what Dr. Shackley was attempting to do was to look at the possibility that some of these reports of wild men, especially in parts of Russia, might be evidence of the existence of ancient human ancestors, archaic humans like Neanderthals, into more recent times, maybe even still existing today. And she gives so many very interesting firsthand accounts, stories that she's collected from Russian hominologists, some that she had obtained while she was doing her fieldwork. And toward the end of the book, after starting really with the myth and folklore of wild men in different traditions, then also spending some time looking at the abominable snowman craze, looking at the American Sasquatch phenomenon, taking us all around the world, but spending a lot of time in Eurasia. And then, of course, closing the book, discussing some of her own archaeological fieldwork there, and trying to lay out the case that some of the descriptions of these things, although often mythologized and described as monsters, hairy beasts, 10 feet tall, she argues that in a lot of these cases, when you remove the hype, what's really being described are much smaller creatures, sometimes even shorter than humans, 5, 5.5, maybe 6 feet tall at most, that actually behave a lot more like people too, but that they look different and that they seem to be more primitive. They have very limited capabilities in terms of speech and vocalizations. And she says this is in keeping anatomically with what we know of the Neanderthal. And it's not impossible, maybe, that in very rare instances, some of these archaic human types might have persisted into more recent times. She talks about going and speaking with some of the natives of the Caucasus, and she'll show them the ancient stone tools that they used, which they find, of course, during archaeological excavations. And she would ask the locals, "Do you know what these tools are? Do you know who made these?" And the locals would often say, "Oh, yes, we know. those were made by the people who lived here before us. And really, that's exactly what you would expect people to say when we're talking about archaic humans who came many thousands of years before us. But they would often add, that was made by the ones who came before us, and they now live in the mountains, and they would point up at the mountains. That's where those people live today. They still live today. And Myra Shackley concludes saying, no doubt there are myths and there are traditions and there's folklore about wild people that might exist in different remote corners of the world. And we can't take all of those seriously. But nonetheless, myths, folklore, and superstitions don't leave footprints in the earth that can be measured, from which casts can be made, and that science can study. And she was one of those rare instances where an archaeologist, an anthropologist, a person of the sciences put her reputation at stake and said, look, you know, here is what I have studied. Here's what I have learned. Here are what my experiences have shown. I think science should at very least entertain this possibility. And that's why Myra Shackley's book is probably one of my favorites on the subject. And yet, you don't hear it mentioned very often these days. And so again, while I don't think that there's any connection between what happened to Igor Dyatlov and his company up there in the Urals in 1959 and the idea of a Russian wild man, it does bother me that the discussion about the potential existence of relict hominoids, as many anthropologists who do entertain the subject prefer to call these, I don't like the idea that that is explicitly relegated to the realm of pseudoscience. And many would rule the possibility out of hand not because it has no connection to the Dyatlov incident, but instead because they take for granted that it is impossible that such things as a Russian wild man could exist at all. I don't think that that's a fair or an accurate interpretation based on what some of the evidence may yield. And yeah, I'll put myself out there and say that, look, I don't have to say I believe. I merely want to look at the evidence and see where that might go. I can be dispassionate. I don't have to be married to it. But I nonetheless think that if one were to truly look at the accumulation of evidence from all over the world, the cultural traditions, the anthropological evidence, the anecdotal eyewitness reports, this is something probably that science should be looking at. That's what I think. And although the clock has caught us here on the primary show, for subscribers this week, we'll definitely delve a little deeper into that side of all this, because although that is unrelated, in my view, to the Dyatlov mystery, I certainly think that science should shine its light on the possibility about these relict hominoids. We will feature some of those accounts that Myra Shackley and others have provided in the literature over the years. That'll be a great topic to delve into with subscribers. But as far as conclusions about the Dyatlov Pass mystery, I don't think that we're close yet to really putting a finger on what this might be. One of the more legitimate ideas is that it could have been a avalanche that occurred. But again, does that account for radiation? Does that account for lights in the skies? And in addition to some of the other content that we're going to go over with subscribers, I want to go deeply into that avalanche idea, but I also am going to provide for the additional X podcast this week some further commentary from a pair of experts, and this was aired only within the last month, which strongly suggests, in the opinion of one forensic examiner, that there was a struggle on the mountain and that there was evidence of self-defense, and then also an editor at one of the newspapers that has covered this incident, who points out additional bizarre details. And I got to tell you, some of this stuff is really mind-numbing, but we've got to take it into consideration if we're going to get to the bottom of this. Something tells me that there's a lot more to this case than meets the eye, and although there might be a simple explanation, we have only begun to scratch the surface. That'll have to be the final word on this week's edition of the program. Thanks as always for being here with us. This show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control in Ogden, Utah are Race Hobbs and Warren Brager. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pentrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. I am Micah Hankson on behalf of all of us here in the bunker. Thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.